and one which hopefully makes us think of what Native Americans have gone through and what they're going through even right now at the hands of this white settler colonial entity. Well, let me get our first guests onto this program to give us a first-hand perspective of all of this.
Juan B. Mancius, the tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe. Juan is the eldest born through a lineage of hereditary chiefs of the Carrizo Comecrudo, but also descends from the Tasuki Pueblo and Kikapo nations. He has held leadership roles as an assistant tribal administrator with the Kikapo traditional tribe of Texas and the tribal administrator of the Scotts Valley Band of Pahwa Indians of California and the Alabama Coushatta tribe of Texas. Today, Juan focuses on decolonizing both tribal people and others. He has written a 12-step decolonization program and presents it frequently at conferences and seminars.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to Hidden Files. Can you tell us about the role reservations played in oppressing the natives?
At the very beginning, I think a lot of the reservations that were set up were set to confine and to change our life ways to the lifestyles. And there's a difference between those life ways and those lifestyles. Our life ways are our traditional values and our traditional beliefs compared to the ideals of lifestyles that was brought here by the colonization. And that became very oppressive because we were practically being brainwashed to change, to accommodate the colonizers that were here. And so for a long time, I think, I know that a lot of our relatives were on other reservations were not allowed to leave the reservation without permission. And that's become commonly most of the undoing of losing a lot of our language, losing a lot of who we are. Of course, then by doing that, they stole a lot of the land.
Well, what are other techniques used by the Europeans, in your perspective, to oppress the natives?
I think that for the longest time, the big oppression in this area has been, the Spanish mission concept of coming in and trying to, they were cutting our hands and cutting our legs and, hanging us and to try to, so those that didn't want to convert. And that happened throughout the Middle Americas, what is called Americas now. So there's a lot of oppression based on being forced to learn one language and to forget your language. The boarding school system was one of those. The missions of this area of the Southwest were another one of those. To the Southwest and through California, they were very oppressive to who you are, who we are, and they outlawed a lot of our ceremonies.
And I mean, what would you say are some of the main problems that natives still face today?
And that's what they did here with the doctrine of discovery. They said if we don't believe the way they do or live the way they do, that they could kill us. And that's what they did for a long time. And here in Texas, up until the 1940s, they were still killing us. And they were finding ways to take away the land, and that's how they did it. And there's still a high percentage of prisons that have a large percentage of people of color. That should tell you something, too, about they still want to control what's there. And if you speak very loudly, you get they'll find ways to get you. So, thing is that they like their system the way it is, and it's only for them. And for the rest of us are just supposed to suck it up, And that's no longer the question here. I'm not here to make the white man comfortable anymore. I'm here to make my people comfortable. So.
And with that, we appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. Stay tuned. We're going to welcome our next guest to the program right after this.
Terrence Nelson, vice chairman of the American Indian Movement. Terrence is also spokesman for the Okieda Warrior Society. He's former chief of Roseau River Anishinaabe First Nation and has written numerous books and booklets.
Thank you so much for joining us here at Hidden Files. How are reservations still being used today, in your perspective, to repress natives?
Well, one of the things is that you can't pledge any lands. You don't have access to the banks because you can't pledge anything on a reservation land. You're denied access to the economy. So United States, the indigenous peoples living on reservations are probably, they're the most impoverished people because it's deliberately set out like that so that the indigenous people don't have the money to fight the system that they find themselves in. So it is it's economic repression.
Well, there are so many tragic events in Native history. One is the Trail of Tears, even significant by its name. Can you talk about this event and others that you think may even affect your people today?
Well, on the Trail of Tears, they just rounded them right up, and they force marched them to Oklahoma. But that was only one area where they ended up doing that. Amongst the Dakotas and North Dakota, South Dakota, they basically rounded up the people and they forced them onto reservations. And then when they didn't want to do that, like there was lots of different, highlights in history where the indigenous people fought back. That's why you have names like Sitting Bull, Frazier Horse, and those ones that like Geronimo, and those ones that have come through history that fought back. They fought back, and they were just small groups of people most of the time. They didn't have a lot of weapons and guns and things like that. They basically fought back as best they could. And the United States Army was extremely well equipped. They had all kinds of manufacturing of Gatling guns. They had all kinds of cannons. They had mounted horses and armies and, fighting against people that were just essentially had to. They hauled their women and their children and their living, and they basically slaughtered all of the buffalo so that the indigenous people didn't have anything to eat. But there was those are things that people don't understand. Yeah. When you don't have anything to eat, when you have your children, you're looking at your children that are starving, and you're trying to fight back. Well, that's what the indigenous people did. And that Trail of Tears you talk about, that's what they did. They essentially force marched them, and they fed them whatever little that they had, and then they basically just the indigenous people were falling off and they were dying. It was because when you, as a parent or as a grandparent, when you see these little kids dying, how horrible is that? People don't understand that. The policies even extended to the residential school area, they call it here in Canada, but on the American side, it was called the boarding schools, where our Native Americans were essentially taken from their homes when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old and taken to a school run by the churches and run by the, and they were forcibly indoctrinated into Christianity. And they were told that they were devil worshipers, these kids, that their parents were heathens and everything else like that. So that's the way that they were taught. What's tragic right now is that the Native Americans and our people are, we don't know the true history of what happened to our people because the one that controls history or the textbooks and is the ones that essentially write the books. And it is the Europeans that wrote the books. So the Trail of Tears is not well known in the U.S. school system. And then they kind of come along and they tell these young white people, that the Native Americans are dependent people, that they get their free money from the United States government and everything else like that. Meanwhile, nobody talks about all of the resources that are sold to keep the to subsidize the Native the American lifestyle. So the gold, the silver, uranium, platinum, oil, trees, water, everything that is now owned by the Europeans and sold to everybody else, they don't pay it to the indigenous people. They pay it to the corporations and to the governments that, that sell this, these products. But it is originally owned by the indigenous people.
Indeed, it is a sad story what happens and continues to happen to the indigenous people. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us. Well, I started off this program by talking about so-called poems and TV shows that ignore the humanity of the natives. And this is still a problem and is endemic of settler colonialism. When it is said that they, the white man, the European, discovered this nation and that they birthed a nation from nothing, these lies add to the facade of white supremacy. Now, the very roots of the United States were laid by Native and African genocide and displacement. When in its own constitution, Thomas Jefferson writes about the merciless Indian savages, how likely can we expect a change in the way Washington deals with the original people of that land? As violence is the foundation of white supremacy and imperialism is nourished by exploitation, it is more likely that viewing and treating natives as less than will continue. So it is the natives themselves who must continue to demand their rights and not remain silent. I end this program with a quote from a native chief, Hedmat Toyolakat, who said, "Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade, where I choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself, and I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. Otherwise, it seems that resistance is the only way." We will definitely be continually to bring you the latest on the natives. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Scientists have listened to the sounds of critically endangered humpback dolphins and pink river dolphins using artificial intelligence. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The scientific publication Nature wrote in this regard, researchers have used artificial intelligence to map the movements of two endangered species of dolphin in the Amazon River by training a neural network to recognize the animal's unique clicks and whistles. The findings, published in scientific reports on July 27th, could lead to better conservation strategies by helping researchers to build an accurate picture of the dolphins' movements across the vast area of rainforest that becomes submerged each year after the rainy season. Using sound is much less invasive than conventional tracking techniques, such as the use of GPS tags, boats, or aerial drones. Co-author Michelle André, a bioacoustician at the Technical University of Catalonia in Barcelona, Spain, said, "Sound is probably the only sense that we know of that we all share on Earth." André and his colleagues wanted to explore the activity of two species, the Boto, also known as the Pink River Dolphin, and the Toxi, across the floodplains of the Mareiro Reserve in northern Brazil. The researchers placed underwater microphones at several sites to eavesdrop on the animals' whereabouts. To distinguish the dolphin sounds from the noisy soundscape of the Amazon, they turn to artificial intelligence, feeding the recordings into a deep learning neural network capable of categorizing sounds in real time, exactly as scientists do with their own brain. Using this technology, researchers can analyze volumes of information that would otherwise be almost impossible, says Federico Mosquera Gura, who studies Amazonian dolphins at the National University of Colombia in Bogota. The artificial intelligence was trained to identify three types of sound: dolphin, rainfall, and boat engines. Both dolphin species use echolocation clicks almost constantly to sense their environment, and they communicate to others by whistling. Detecting these clicks and whistles enabled the researchers to map the animals' movements. Botos and toxis have distinct whistles, so the neural network could distinguish between the species. The study is part of a collaboration between the Technical University of Catalonia and the Mareiro Institute of Sustainable Development in Tefé, Brazil, which aims to use this technology for monitoring the Amazon's biodiversity and threats to it. Both dolphin species are endangered. Estimates suggest that the Boto population is declining by 50% every 10 years, and the Toxi population every 9 years. Monitoring when and where the animals move will allow researchers to help protect their populations and come up with measures to help indigenous communities to cohabitate with the presence of dolphins, says André. Dolphins can disrupt fisheries across the floodplains, for example, by competing for fish or becoming tangled in nets. Mosquera Gura says that collecting such information is fundamental to inform decisions on conservation across the Amazon region. In future, the team wants to train the neural network to detect other aquatic species and to deploy the system over a wider area. The same approach could also be used in the ocean. André's previous work using this system has shown the effects of human-made noise pollution on sperm whales and has enabled the development of a warning system for ships to help avoid the animals. According to other reports, the artificial intelligence was trained to identify three types of sound: dolphin, rainfall, and boat engines. Both dolphin species use echolocation clicks almost constantly to sense their environment, and they communicate to others by whistling. Detecting these clicks and whistles enabled the researchers to map the animals' movements.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel's foreign minister has agreed with his Bahraini counterpart to boost trade relations during his first visit to one of the two Persian Gulf Arab states to establish ties with Israel.
His Excellency, my friend, the foreign minister, and I agreed that we should work together to increase the number of direct flights, the tourism, the trade volume, the investment.
Cohen made the remarks during a ceremony to inaugurate Israel's new embassy in Bahrain on Monday. The embassy in the capital, Manama, will replace the first embassy Israel opened in 2021, a year after it normalized diplomatic relations with Bahrain as part of the United States brokered Abraham Accords, which were also signed with the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan. Monday's ceremony was attended by Bahraini Foreign Minister Abdul Latif Al-Zayani, who said the new embassy assumes a pivotal role in growing collaboration between Manama and Tel Aviv.
I welcome the opportunity for fruitful and constructive discussions with Foreign Minister Cohen, reflecting our shared desire to further advance our bilateral relations across the broadest range of fields, including economic, investment, trade, and other areas of cooperation.
Cohen arrived in Bahrain on Sunday, accompanied by a business delegation of more than 30 companies working in high-tech, logistics, and real estate. Earlier on Monday, he met Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa and discussed the importance of advancing a free trade agreement and projects to connect youths in Israel and Bahrain. His visit, initially scheduled for early August, was postponed by Bahrain last month in response to one of the frequent raids of Al-Aqsa Mosque by far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Cohen's trip to Manama is the first one by an Israeli official in the current far-right cabinet. This is also Cohen's first official trip since his office set off a diplomatic firestorm with Libya last week after his office unilaterally disclosed details of a secret meeting he held with former Libyan Foreign Minister Najla Mangouche in Italy. The revelation set off protests across the North African nation and led to the firing of Mangouche, who was also forced to flee to London. The opening of the Israeli mission in Bahrain took place 3 years after the Al Khalifa regime and United Arab Emirates signed U.S. brokered normalization agreements with Israel in an event in Washington. Sudan and Morocco also followed suit and inked similar U.S. brokered normalization deals with the occupying regime. The Bahraini people have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime by holding demonstrations. Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wefaq, and the kingdom's top cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, have also repeatedly condemned the normalization move by the Al-Khalifa dynasty. The move has sparked widespread condemnations from the Palestinians, as well as nations and human rights advocates across the globe, especially within the Muslim world. Palestinians slammed the deals as a treacherous stab in the back and a betrayal of their cause against the decades-long Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories.
Leaders of Palestinian-Lebanese resistance movements have gathered together in Lebanon's capital, Beirut, to discuss a range of issues including anti-Israeli operation by Palestinian groups as well as Tel Aviv threats. The meeting brought together Secretary General of Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, head of the Hamas political office, Saleh al-Aruri, and Secretary General of the Lebanese Hezbollah Movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah. The three leaders exchanged views on latest political developments in the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as recent Israeli threats. The resistance leaders underlined their unwavering and bedrock support for all resistance groups encountering the Israeli occupation. The meeting between resistance leaders comes at a time when tensions are high across the region due to Israeli policies. The occupied Palestinian land, Nablus and Jenin in particular, have been the scene of the regime's raids, resulting in a large number of fatalities. Israeli regime forces attacked Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on July the 3rd, murdering at least 12 Palestinians. They also injured up to 100 others. Some 500 Palestinian families were forced or had to leave their homes due to the Israeli deadly assault. The regime has also carried out numerous raids in the occupied Al-Quds, with settlers backed by Israeli forces killing and injuring Palestinians. Many have described the Israeli intention to carry out those raids in the occupied Al-Quds as seeking to tighten the grip on Palestinian people. But Tel Aviv has not sufficed to that. Israeli officials have made numerous comments calling for more pressure against Palestinians. One significant instance was the Israeli far-right minister Etmar Ben-Gavir, who repeatedly called for exerting pressure on Palestinian detainees, which has resulted in inmates languishing in regime jails, to start hunger strikes to protest the growing Israeli violence. The growing Israeli violence in the occupied territories have simply resulted in rising anti-Israeli operations, with stabbing attacks, rocket strikes, and other sorts of operations being reported almost on a daily basis. Those attacks are only in response to calls by resistance leaders to enhance anti-Israeli operations across the occupied land. Such calls have made the regime officials to threaten to assassinate Palestinian resistance leaders, blaming them for the intensification of resistance against Tel Aviv. Palestinian Hamas movement has reaffirmed that Tel Aviv's threats to assassinate resistance leaders will lead to a confrontation and that the regime will pay its price. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has echoed Hamas' warning, stressing that Israeli threats will only increase Palestinian people and fighters' determination to adhere to the option of resistance in words, actions, and behavior, and to insist on responding to any crime the Israeli regime plans to commit. Additionally, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Freedom Movement, Yasser Khalaf, said that such threats do not frighten the Palestinian people and will not impact the strategy of enhancing and developing the resistance strength and performance. He sent a message to the Israeli leaders not to make wrong calculations regarding the situation, as what awaits them will be far greater than expected. Those calls have been reiterated by Said Hassan Nasrallah, who just recently said that Israel will be returned to the Stone Age if it goes to war with Lebanon. Taking a brief look at those remarks, what they all have in common is that Palestinian resistance is determined to stand firm against Israeli atrocities. This also shows that the resistance has expanded beyond the occupied territories and will continue to expand day after day to the extent which can endanger the future of Israeli occupying regime. anti-French sentiment is high in Niger as thousands gathered outside the French military base in the capital Niamey to demand the withdrawal of French forces and its ambassadors from the African country. Wearing and waving Niger's flag, demonstrators chanted anti-French slogan, expressing their full support for the country's military government. The demonstrators demanded that Western countries, especially France, respect their choice.
Not our sole demand.
Our only request, our ultimate request, is the departure. The departure. The departure of the French who are on Niger territory. We don't need these people here. We don't need, and we repeat, we are ready to die to defend our homeland. We are ready to die to get them out. They must leave. We don't need them here.
We're here and we'll be here forever until the day France packs up and packs up its will. I tell you, France has to move out because it's not its country. It's our country. It's our territory. And well, France has to move out.
The anger in Niger grew especially after the French president said his country did not recognize the military government there. Emmanuel Macron has said he's in regular contact with Niger's deposed president Mohamed Bazoum. Nigerian junta has blasted Macron's comments, saying their remarks constitute blatant interference in their domestic affairs. But regardless of those reactions, the European Union said it was imposing sanctions against the military junta in Niger as part of efforts to force its leaders to hand over power to a civilian rule.
We have also decided to initiate a process for the establishment of a legal framework for individual sanctions against the putschists, and we are ready to listen to other suggestions from ECOWAS. They explained to us the situation on the ground and how ECOWAS is considering the possibility of a military deployment on the ground.
And instead of expressing support for the people of Niger, who have been under the French colonial rule for decades, Borrell expressed a bloc solidarity with Paris.
The ministers reiterated the strong condemnation of the military coup in Niger, called for the release of President Bazoum and his family, and to go back to the constitutional order. This is something that has been involving, in particular, France. We express our solidarity with France.
The anger and resentment in Niger comes as the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, under the direct influence of France, has threatened to deploy military force in the West African nation in an effort to reinstate ousted President Bazoum. That after the military junta took power following a coup on July 26 and placed President Bazoum under house arrest in what many described as an anti-French revolution in Niger. But what is the root cause of all that hatred against France? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is according to UN figures considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all its grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across Africa, but reverberated across Europe. That's due to the fact that Niger is home to its strategic mineral reserves such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. The interesting point, though, is that France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the United States. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate would be waiting for many across other Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they are the ones who should put an end to the decades of West's occupation and economic exploitation of their countries.
It's a plot out of a Hollywood movie, but with serious repercussions. The shadow war between Israel and Iran. This one involves an Israeli plot to sabotage Iran's defense industry, including missiles, the biggest military sabotage attempt against Iran in the past 100 years. It is one that failed, however, just in the nick of time. The agency's statement reveals the scope of the operation. The intelligence unit of the Defense Ministry thwarted one of the largest sabotage plots targeting Iran's missile, aviation, and aerospace military industry. This sabotage was carried out under the guidance of the Zionist intelligence services and their agents. A network of agents sought to introduce defective parts into the production of advanced missiles, specifically defective connectors from abroad. The defective parts were discovered by the Defense Ministry Information Protection. The plan was to equip these connectors with explosive circuits. If that was done successfully, the connectors could be programmed to explode remotely at any time. But how was this plot unfoiled?
اون فردی که اشاره کردید که لو داد و اینا میشه یه مقداری از جزئیاتش اگه امکان داره
بله ایشون یک فرد در واقع غیر نظامی بود خب در همین شبکه خرید بود که شرکت هایی که کار میکرد و ایشون
ایرانی؟
خودش بله ایرانی بود خودش حساس میشه به این که چرا مثلا اون طرف خارجی و اونایی که دارن به ایشون این قطعات رو میفروشن این میاد مثلا داخل توزیع میکنه چرا حساس شدن حتی اینها بررسی میکردن توی بازار خرید داخل مراکزی که توزیع کننده این قطعات بودن اطلاعات جمع‌آوری میکردن و ایشون حساس میشه میاد با همکارای ما در سازمان حفاظت اطلاعات در میون میذاره و همکارا چون اطلاعات دیگری هم داشتن بله. که یک علائمی رو از قبل به دست آورده بودن اینها رو تقاطع اطلاعاتی میدن با تقاطع اطلاعاتی و با کمک ایشون بقیه شبکه کم کم تحت شناسایی قرار میگیره منتها به گونه ای که به هیچ وجه موساد و سرویس رژیم صهیونیستی متوجه این اشرافیت اطلاعاتی ایران نشد
Under the false pretext of preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, Mossad has been carrying out a campaign of sabotage and cyber attacks on Iran's civilian nuclear program for quite some time. One of the notorious ones was the Stuxnet virus. In April 2011, Iranian government official Ghulam Reza Jalali stated that investigation had concluded that both the United States and Israel were behind the Stuxnet attack. Mossad has also methodically assassinated and murdered Iranian nuclear scientists, from magnetic bombs attached to the side of their cars to the use of poison, and allegedly the use of a killer robot remotely used as an assassin. Additionally, Israel has also targeted Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel's targeting of Iran's defense industry, in particular its drones and missile program, does make sense from Israel's point of view. Iran has made extraordinary advancements in these two fields and military hardware overall. But all of these destructive actions, which Israel has not claimed responsibility for, has not been able to stop Iran's advancement. From Israel's perspective, it makes strategic sense, though only a temporary fix. There's an Iranian saying that says, "Don't play with the lion's tail." Iran may have thwarted these acts of sabotage, but for how long will its patience last when it comes to Israel?
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
European household bills have soared since Western countries largely abandoned Russian oil, natural gas, and coal supplies. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, energy prices across the EU have been surging, raising the prospect of higher household bills as the bloc prepares for another winter with drastically reduced Russian natural gas supplies. The cost of electricity in Italy jumped nearly 30% in the week from August 21st to August 27th, reaching 138 euros per megawatt hour. According to estimates by research group Nomisma Energia, starting from October 1st, Italian families could face a 7% to 10% hike in their electricity bills. It cited rising gas prices as the major cause, as Italy is one of the most natural gas-dependent countries in the EU. The president of Nomisma Energia, David Tabarelli, warned recently that if prices remain at these levels, it is inevitable that they will be reflected in an increase in future electricity bills. According to Tabarelli, as quoted by Italy 24 Press News, projections for next winter indicate international prices are 40% higher than current ones, and if they materialize, gas tariffs for the winter could be 20% higher than current levels. Elsewhere in the EU, energy costs have also continued to climb, with the average wholesale electricity price in Estonia rocketing by 93% to 153.39 euros per megawatt hour in the last week. Prices in both Latvia and Lithuania soared 23% to 142.58 euros per megawatt hour. Electricity prices in the EU surged last year following the bloc's decision to heavily restrict Russian oil and gas and fully ban coal supplies as part of its sanctions policy. France, which was once a net power exporter to the EU, had to rely heavily on electricity imports from neighboring countries last winter. Many of its nuclear power plants, which accounted for 70% of the country's electricity output, have been offline for maintenance. According to Bloomberg, France has extended permission for power-generating companies to burn more coal in the coming month in order to prevent shortages this winter. The move comes as the output of utility major Électricité de France, EDF, which provides over half of France's electricity, will reportedly remain below historical levels this winter due to problems with its fleet of nuclear reactors affected by stress corrosion, the outlet said. Tension on the power system is currently lower than at the same period of last year, the French Ecological Transition Ministry said, referring to the prospects of wind and solar output and a drop in energy consumption. However, one must take all measures to ensure security of energy supply for the French in any event, it added, noting the possibility that the conflict in Ukraine may not be over by winter or that the winter itself will be very tough. At the same time, the French government has tightened the requirements for the operation of the country's two remaining coal-fired power plants. Electricity producers will only be allowed to operate for up to 1,800 hours in the coming winter, or about 11 weeks, down from 2,500 hours last winter, according to the French ministry. Under a government decree, coal-powered plants will have to pay more per ton of carbon dioxide released. Power prices in the EU soared last year following the bloc's decision to abandon Russian energy as part of its sanctions policy. France, which was once a power exporter to the EU, had to rely heavily on electricity imports from neighboring countries last winter. Many of its nuclear power plants, which accounted for 70% of the country's electricity output, have been offline for maintenance. Also, according to the news outlet Bild, Germany has had to ramp up electricity imports in the first 6 months of the year after the government decided to shut down the country's last remaining nuclear power plants in favor of renewable energy sources. From January 1st to June 12th, the EU's largest economy relied on power supplies from neighboring countries, the outlet said, citing the cabinet's response to a parliamentary inquiry. Germany can no longer meet its demand with domestically generated power, the report stated, due to a green energy policy disaster that saw nuclear plants closed in favor of renewables. Berlin now relies on imports of electricity produced at French atomic facilities and on supplies generated at local plants in the Czech Republic. Energy expert Andre Tess told TASS news agency, according to publicly available data, Germany has turned from an exporter of electricity into an importer. This is most likely due to the abandonment of nuclear power plants. Germany industry executives earlier sounded the alarm over looming electricity shortages that could endanger the competitiveness of Germany as an industrial hub. The head of energy firm RWE, Markus Kreber, warned last month, "As an industrial location, Germany has a serious problem. We don't have as much energy available as we need. This gap leads to high prices and thus to justified concerns about competitiveness," he said, adding, "We are seeing the first signs of deindustrialization." According to RT, Germany pledged to abandon nuclear power after Japan's 2011 Fukushima catastrophe. In April, Berlin shut down its last three nuclear power stations, ending a six-decade nuclear program in favor of fully renewable electricity generation by 2035. The initial plan was to use more Russian gas during the transition period via the Nord Stream pipelines, which were built to deliver cheap fuel from Russia. Prior to the conflict in Eastern Europe, Germany met up to 40% of its demand with gas from the sanctioned country. However, the sabotage of the natural gas pipelines and Western penalties imposed on Moscow prompted Berlin to search for alternative supplies. Last year, Berlin replaced some of its Russian gas with imports of LNG from the West Asia region and the U.S. But economists have warned that it would take years for Germany to fully substitute Russian supplies with other sources of energy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Reasons behind enemies targeting Islam is the political rules of Islam. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps on August 17, 2023, in the Imam Khomeini's Hosseiniyeh. We have few organizations that are able to match the IRGC's success in building infrastructure such as the nation's roads, highways, dams, refineries, and the like. The IRGC does the same work at a lower cost and at a faster rate. This is a very important honorable chapter. Another chapter is the IRGC's public service. The IRGC has stood by the people in various sectors. In the health sector, which is very important sector, the IRGC has been able to do great things. It has also provided essential aid during natural disasters, such as in earthquakes, floods, and coronavirus pandemic, and the like, and in eliminating economic deprivation. One of the sectors that continues to be unknown and an adequate report of it has not yet been given to the people is about the measures taken by the IRGC to eliminate economic deprivation faced by the weaker sectors of the society. Great things and extensive work has been done in this regard. Another important chapter which should also be taken into consideration is the influence of the IRGC has in the country's public sphere.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It is natural that a group like the IRGC with the aforementioned characteristic is genuinely appealing to the younger generation. The youth look and see that knowledge and action are intertwined in this organization. Hard power and soft power are intertwined. Hard power consists of missiles, drones, and such things. Soft power consists of being present among the people, talking with people, and helping them. Both of these things exist. Maintaining ideals along with paying attention to the realities and dealing with them exists in the IRGC. When the youth see that an organization is communicating with the people and see its BCG presence next to the people, it is appealing to them. These things are appealing to young people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
23-year-old Wazir Azrar arrives at the Federal Agency for Asylum Seekers in Brussels, having been in Belgium for 6 months. Wazir says Western powers destroyed his country, Afghanistan, and now help is not available. Officials at the agency rejected his documents.
I have been waiting for that for 6 months. I've been sleeping on the street, also like in the park, yeah. This is a big problem here in Belgium for the Afghan refugees and also for the Syrian refugees, you know.
A coach full of families then arrives, and those people are granted access to the asylum application centre. This is because the Belgian government, led by Alexander De Croo, says male refugees travelling alone are no longer welcome in the country.
They're thinking we are just animals and refugees. They don't respect us. That's why I came here. For example, we need like doctors, like these very important things, but they don't care also.
Hundreds of men, mainly from Africa and the Middle East, are sleeping on the streets of Belgium. At the same time, the country is providing full protection to 62,000 Ukrainian refugees. They enjoy the same rights as EU citizens. The European Commission says it is aware of reports that Belgium is rejecting asylum applications from non-Ukrainian single men.
We understand that these are announcements at this stage, so this is still being discussed by the Belgian government, so we will need to see what is exactly happening, and the Commission will be contacting also the Belgian authorities in this respect.
De Croo's administration insists families, women and children must be prioritised as winter approaches. Groups such as Amnesty International claim the Belgian government has reached a new low. They